You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 17 of Ethnosynology. I'm your host, David Ian Howe, and today I'm going to talk about a film that I've wanted to make a video about for a long time, and I get questions about this all the time, so let me just do it. And that's the 2018 film Alpha, which is directed by Albert Hughes. I don't know anything else that he's directed, and the cinematography was done by Martin Geschlacht. Never heard of him either, but I will tell you, if you want a synopsis of the movie, it is The Revenant for children. I would say that. And if you've seen The Revenant, which is an awesome movie, which I should have added to the apocalypse movies list, because The Revenant itself is an apocalypse film about the apocalypse that the indigenous Americans faced at the peak of American or colonial and then American expansion into the West. And it's shot in a bleak, dark, gray tone. There's a lot of just indigenous murder and bad stuff in the movie, and that's getting away from it. But this one has less of that tone to it, but has more of the sweeping landscapes, this takes place in Paleolithic France, not the Louisiana Purchase, but a lot more beautifully stunning. The Revenant was beautiful in itself. I'll detach from The Revenant here, but this one was more of a more kid-friendly version of that, less dark. The story was less dark. But in terms of, first of all, if you've never seen the movie, go ahead and watch it before I spoil it, but I will go over the movie and then talk about the themes in it. But mainly, though, the story, you could boil it down into a hunter-gatherer tribe goes on a big hunt. The kid gets isolated from the tribe because he gets hurt, and then he meets a wolf, and then that wolf and him form a bond, and that wolf and the kid make the first human dog relationship, the first human canine bond, and then he finds his way back home. So it's a coming of age story. There's quite a bit in it. There's a lot of stuff that went into it, like the language, and I should have pulled up her name, but they hired a linguist to reconstruct the language. And I'll just say this right off the bat, we don't know what they spoke in Paleolithic France. We know eventually they spoke an Indo-European or Proto-Indo-European dialect that came with farmers and goat herders from the Middle East, probably Turkey area, and that took over all of Europe. We don't really know what was spoken before that. There's Proto-Dene-Caucasiatic, Proto-Dene-Caucasiatic is related to basically Navajo. It's a language that was spoken across Eurasia really long ago that split off into what came into the Americas and what came into France. And some people think Basque could possibly be related, came from something like that. Who knows? Anybody who has a firm answer on that is just making shit up. I would say that. But that also ties into another aspect of the movie that is quite interesting. And it was originally going to be called The Salutrian, because it's the Salutrian people in the movie, but they changed the name due to the controversy. They didn't want to have anything. It had nothing to do with the Americas, of course. It had to do with the Salutrian people who lived in ancient France. The Salutrian culture was an upper Paleolithic culture that existed in Europe, specifically France and Spain, about 21,000 to 17,000 years ago. And they are just an upper Paleolithic people that lived in highly complex social groups. And I always say highly complex social groups in relation to dogs and wolves, but this was a quintessential Paleolithic culture that wasn't Gravettian, that wasn't Argnashian. It was a very distinct culture, and they had a very distinct tool that they made. This is not one, this is an axe, called a Salutrian point, which is a lancelet point, it's more of a leaf shape. I'll put a picture of it here, but if you're listening, just look it up. A Salutrian point has bifacial flaking. It looks very similar to how a Clovis point is made. However, Salutrian points don't have a flute or a concave and rounded base at the bottom like a Clovis point does, but there's the whole Salutrian theory in which Clovis people might have came from the Salutrian culture in France, made their way across the ice sheets, following the ice in boats, and made their way to the Chesapeake Bay, where they find similar points. And I think that's a very far-fetched idea. Anything's possible, but saying that means anything's possible. I don't want to go there. But there's no genetic evidence. There's no linguistic evidence for this whatsoever. The technological evidence is faint at best. I would say less than 1% evidence of it. So there's nothing to it. But the Salutrian hypothesis you will hear several times. And I got a lot of hate in my Bone Needle video because I put pictures of Paleo Indians who had beards in the painting. And someone was like, this guy's promoting Salutrian hypothesis as a white supremacist. And it's no, we don't know what their facial hair looked like 15,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, and especially 13,000 years ago in Wyoming. We don't know that. We aren't able to do too much testing on Native American remains at that age to know if they had the genes for that. And also, it's 13,000 years ago. Who's to say what they exactly look like? And that's getting to besides the point. But all of that aside, that's why they changed this movie from didn't want to support, you know, get into any white supremacy kind of things or have white supremacists coming out being like, whites were in America first. Bro. And the funny thing, too, is the Salutian culture wouldn't have been white skinned at all. They'd have been like a hefty shade of brown at this time in France, just like everybody else was until like, honestly, until agriculture came in from Turkey, did white skin apparently come into Europe. So it's just a moot point. But anyway, I'm digressing for the people that aren't too into to that. The movie, let's just break it down. I said the themes are coming of age, but it's a really survival, I guess would be another theme. But it's a, how do I describe this? It's just a cute movie. It's like a buddy, not buddy cop, a guy makes friends with a dog. And the main character of the story is Cody Smith McPhee, who was the little boy in The Road with Viggo Mortensen, the Cormac McCarthy story. So I wanted to mention the props, which will come into play in this, and then some cultural aspects, which I guess I'll just do as I go through. But one thing I really, there were obviously some inaccuracies in this film, there's going to be, but it was probably one of the truest depictions of Paleolithic camp life that I've seen. They clearly had a flint napper on set showing the flint napping, how to do flint napping, and they clearly had someone there supervising that. And specifically, they had must have had somebody there doing the clothing because their clothing was just top notch. And especially if you listen to the Bone Needle episode, how important fine tailored clothing was for the Ice Age. And this movie did a very good. It was a very good example of showing like how fine tailored the clothing would have had to have been to keep warm, especially in Paleolithic France. Now, it would have been a little warmer in Paleolithic France than in Wyoming, but it was still the Ice Age. So we'll dive in. But they had sinew hafted points, like their points were correct. They weren't just done dumb. Their clothing was fantastic. They had necklaces. They had jewelry. It wasn't just a hide poncho. They had stone points. They had a bow and arrow comes up at some point in the movie, which is not accurate for the time, but whatever. Painting stuff. They had face paint, painting on their houses. They had a lot of worn garments and tight seams, like I was saying earlier. That it, you had to have these things. It wasn't just a frock or like a draped over hide back then. Like these people were highly sophisticated people, which I think is fascinating. But the beginning of the movie, you see these like amazing sweeping landscapes of Paleolithic France. It hits you and it says France 20,000 years ago, or Europe 20,000 years ago, presumably France. 20,000 years ago would have been right about the time of the Salutrian in France, which was, Salutrian I think was an offshoot of Gravettian culture. I could be wrong. I'm not an old world archaeologist, but someone correct me there. But you see these sweeping landscapes of mammoths and woolly rhinos, bison. Eventually you see hyenas in the movie. And it was like a mix of The Revenant and like the live action animated Lion King. Like I can't describe it any other way. It was very cool the way it just looked. It was just visually pretty. And you can tell the foreground was all stage, like a set. And then right behind that was just purely blue screen or green screen. I think blue screen in this case from what I saw in the behind the scenes stuff. But sweeping stuff, the CGI did not look bad. There's a lot of cool stuff with the cinematography that I thought was really good. Just really getting you into that time period. But the beginning movie starts off and it's a whole group of hunter-gatherer. I believe there's men. There might have been women in it too. I'll double check that. I remember someone pointing out there were women in it. But they're all crawling on the ground looking at a herd of bison near a cliff. And there's a point where a guy, like, ants are crawling on his hand and he, like, eats the ants, which my friend pointed out was a nice touch because you're optimally foraging. Like, you wouldn't have been opposed to eating ants, especially if you're hungry trying to hunt all these bison. And this is where the movie starts to, 2 minutes in, starts to derail. But it doesn't really derail much after this. This is one of the weirdest points of the movie. They all get up from crawling to hunt these bison, right? And then they get up and then yell and then throw their finely napped spears that are on javelins. They're not on atlatls or bows. They're just throwing spears. Throw them into the ground to create a fence to stop the bison from running at them and that the bison will redirect and then hopefully run off the cliff. Now, if you spend all that time making this is crude, but you spend the time making like a really nice stone point. Sorry for the listeners, I just picked up one. If you spend all that time, you're not going to just take it and throw it into the ground. It will break. They're very fragile, especially if you're throwing them into the rocky ground. I'd imagine based on Indigenous American stuff, they would have lit fires to, you know, direct the fire drives to get them to do different things, maybe even just wear wolf pelts or something. You wouldn't just throw your spears into the ground. That was really weird. I don't know why they did this in the movie, but whatever. It was better than 10,000 BC. And the bison are running right at them, which is also crazy to me. I don't really think bison would have done that, but they're running away from the cliff. And then the bison, they all run off the edge of the cliff. And bison jumps are a huge thing in North America. And there's this whole, it's a noble savage myth, really, where it's, oh, they ate everything from the snout to the tail. They Native Americans didn't. That's a myth. They absolutely didn't. There's huge bison bone beds where there's, let's say, two dozen, maybe 50 bison falling off a cliff in this scene, at least. But in real life, that's happened. You can't possibly get down there and harvest every single bit of it. That didn't always happen. You got the big cuts you needed and you left. And I know for a fact in Europe, this was a big thing. There's like huge horse butchering sites in France and Spain like this too, where they just ran horses off the cliff, butchered the shit out of them, and just took the cuts they wanted. That same thing happened in North America, and like it's not talked about as much, and it's just Native Americans lived in harmony until the whites got here. Absolutely not. They like also were people with fallacies too, and not even that this is a fallacy. This is just that they took the optimal meat they needed and left. They didn't need much more. And in North America, for sure, bison existed all over the place. They lived like past the Mississippi River. They lived in Tennessee. And I, from my understanding, there's no bison that I've seen at a site that early, like in the Pleistocene sites, bison in like the South. In Mississippian times, I don't see a single bison. I haven't seen one anywhere that I've known or that I've dug all over there. And until you get to, let's say, like 1800s and stuff, 1700s, more to come in. And that's probably because the natives hunted them almost to extinction too, just like any other megafauna, pushed them out and they went back to the plains where they could live because it was hard for people to live in the plains for a long time. So that's digressing, but this, I'm talking about France here. I'll digress. But anyway, bison are an enigma all over the world in this sense, and they're technically a megafauna to me. They still are. Bison antiquus obviously being a bigger megafauna, but these would be European steppe bison, I think. Anyway, they throw up spears, the bison go off the cliff, but then the kid gets gored by a bison, and it like hooks, the horn hooks onto his clothes, his fine tailored clothes, and he like takes a tumble off the cliff, just like in Aragorn in the Return of the Two Towers, which, because, and then the dad's like, no, and his name is Kata, I think, and he's yelling for his son, who of course falls off the cliff. He's holding onto the cliff, and he's about to fall, and then when they finally see that he's still holding on, the rock of course breaks, and then he falls further to a nice little Star Wars perch on the side of the thing where he somehow Palpatine returned. He's still like laying there on the side of the thing, but his leg's broken, he's knocked out, and the father's screaming and crying, which I think I noticed twice in this movie too. The father screaming for his son, and they're showing you all these animals and stuff like that, and like bonding and like caring for each other. Humans screaming for their kid is the same thing as when a cow is screaming for its infant, or the infant screaming for its mom, or a bird's chirping, right? It's that same thing, but we just have language to it. And at points when the kid comes to and he saves himself, he's screaming for his father. I can't remember the father's name or how he said it in that language, but screaming in like at the top of his lungs for that. And it's the same thing as I saw a cow. It's really sad. A cow when I was doing a project on a ranch, and the baby cow was stuck on the other side of the barbed wire, and the mom couldn't get to it. And the mom was like screaming, and it was like hard to stomach. It was not hard to hear. It was loud, but hard to stomach because like that baby was going to die. And then like, an hour or two later, it like passed out. Or it probably had passed out and then woken up and then passed out again. There were vultures circling it, and it eventually died. We tried to tell the ranchers. Anyway, couldn't get there in time. But like it had been there dying for a day or so, and the mom was just like screaming, and it's like a very mammalian thing. And like the movie clearly, I don't know if the director gave the kid that tip to do, but it was very like interesting in terms of how we're all animals back then. You know what? Before we get further into the movie, I'm going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. And we're back. So now the kid, eventually, he saves himself, but we see time in the movie jumps back, and we're back at camp. And this is a really cool version of a Paleolithic camp. There's flint napping, and then as they're flint napping, they're flint napping correctly. Like they had someone on set showing them what to do, which I thought was excellent. Which is funny, because in the movie Prey, which is an all indigenous cast movie except for the French trappers, Prey was a prequel to Predator, and it had Amber Midthunder, who is awesome in the movie. And at one point she's like sharpening her arrowhead or her knife, and she's just like taking a rock and scraping it, which is exactly what they do in the Disney Pocahontas movie. That's cartoon. They're like sharpening that, which I found funny. They had an entire like native cast, an entire like linguist, like redo all the stuff to speak the language. I don't remember what they were speaking in the movie, but I know you can watch the whole movie dubbed in it. Can't recall. Carlton would know. Anyway, they don't sharpen the stone, which I found funny in a fully indigenous movie. But in this movie, they clearly had a Paleolithic guy, probably some French instructor or professor, show them what to do, French napper. And then when they all flint nap correctly and do the point correctly, they all get the shit kicked out of them for some reason. It's like a gang initiation thing, which is cool because anthropologically rite of passage is one of the main constants of human culture, along with marriage, funerals, coming of age, rite of passage, and then I said funerals, death. Yeah. So that's like pretty common. Not that they would kick the shit out of you for doing correctly on this thing, but I found it quite cool that they added that. And then you can see familiar groups. There's a father and a mother. Now, when I learned hunter-gatherer stuff, there isn't always like a clear like patrilineal or matrilineal like mother and son nuclear family unit. That's a new thing in history. They might have all seen each other as nieces, nephews, cousins. But the father and mother in this, to humanize the audience to us, there's father and mother who clearly love the kid. There's a shaman. Or they give each other necklaces and gift-giving, obviously, with the newer and the Marcel Mauss is the gift. They like gift giving is a huge thing in anthropology. So like showing that is cool. And the gift, the necklace signifies that they're ready to be a man or hunt. And then there's a shaman blessing the hunt. I thought that was really cool. Shamanism in the movie, like they did a really good, like a good visual representation of what Paleolithic life might've looked like, in my opinion. And then there's a scene where there's the husband and the wife are sleeping and they're worrying about the sun, and the sun's like awake 3 feet from them, and worrying that he's not going to be good enough. And I always find this funny too, like in Dance with Wolves or like any of these old movies where people lived in big teepees or yurts, did they just have sex like right there with the children around? Did they kick them out? Did they go off somewhere? Did they all just sleep right there and have fights right in front of the kids or like maybe their cousins and brothers and sisters? I don't know. Now, this movie did show that though, that they are all in the same little yurt. It was like a mammoth bone hut. But the mother is, of course, worrying that the son's not ready. The son looks like 22 in the movie, but I guess he's supposed to be like 13. She's worried he's not going to be strong enough. He's not going to be a good hunter. And like, I think by the age of 7 back then, you'd have to know how to flint knap. You'd have to know how to make fire, and you'd have to know how to hunt to survive, unless they like culturally kept that from you. I don't know. That's a theme in the movie that I found funny, that like this kid was just like saying he's a pussy is too... like if that's, you can't use that word anymore, but they just made a point to show he was just like, I don't know the word for that. It was like, he was just inept, like everything and scared of stuff until the story comes, but then can't. So then we leave camp, and this is, remember before he fell off the cliff, we leave camp and there's a long hunt and they have to trek to go find this hunt. And this is something that we always talk about in hunter-gatherer science. The division of labor isn't just to be sexist. It's to be like, breastfeeding women have to be there with their children to feed them, or women of breastfeeding age, because you know, if you talk about fecundity and the grandmothering hypothesis, other women that are lactating for their children can feed other children. That's a hunter-gatherer thing. But it wasn't just men went on the hunt because, oh, me big, strong. It was like the hunt is a long, strenuous thing where you have to go hunt, might not have food for days. You can't bring a child on it. That's common in hunter-gatherer society for that reason. I can't recall if they're a woman. You can't really tell. They're all wearing parkas and they all have long hair. So there might have been women in this. But for the most part, it looked like men, at least the main characters were. And long hunts require endurance and skill. It's not for children. So I think that was a part of the movie. He's not strong enough, blah, blah, blah. And it's not just, you got to be a man, like hunter-gatherer, the man, the hunter. It was like, it requires a lot. You got to be like David Goggins to go hunt after bison and stuff back then. Maybe not David Goggins, but. And there's scenes where they're trying to make fire and the kid doesn't know how to make fire, which I find utterly insane. Like, obviously we have lighters now, we can do it as a kid, but not knowing how to make fire is odd. And then there's cairns for like landmarks, which definitely was a thing. I thought that was a neat touch, marking territory. And there wasn't really a concept of, it depends on what kind of hunter-gatherers you are and where you are, but I'd imagine there wasn't just like people defending the territory with like troops back then. It was just like loose, this is our patch that we hunt, this is your patch. And they'd meet up to have aggregations where they meet and trade and speak and then trade children for genetic exchange and stuff, but for rights to land and treaties. And you see another group meet up and they do that thing. Exchange culture. The kid, he can't kill the boar. He's too scared to eventually hunt a boar. The kid's too scared to kill it and end it. And the dad's, I got it. And it just, that's overdone. Kids back then would have had no issue with that, I'd imagine. But that's, of course, humanizing the audience and it makes sense for the story. They get hunted by a big cat at night, which definitely was a thing, pre-dogs. I thought that was a nice aspect of the movie. Let's see. Yeah, and then there's a scene where they're all, like, they met up with this other clan, and they're all hunting together, and they end up in this big cave, and they're all tattooing each other, which, again, tattoos falls into a rite of passage, but also a very anthropological thing. Much like marriage or rites of passage or funerals or having dogs, tattooing is an innately human thing. And he tattoos using bone and stone, which I had done, which is awesome, and it hurts. Not too terribly, though. Tattooing constellations on their hands. So, like, using, you can lose your hand to look up at the sky and see the constellation and know your way back home, which I thought was interesting. That was a neat touch that I didn't expect. It's like a Polynesian thing. And they're talking astronomy. But the next scene, though, which is the most important of the movie with his father, is they hear wolves howling. And the father, like, he looks like great value Jason Momoa, Walmart brand. But he points to a wolf and he's, the alpha is their leader and the alpha must care for his pack. And like, the father is the tribal leader, I believe. But he's also always in danger because the others want to challenge him or they'll sense his weakness. But he needs to let him know, the alpha, and I wrote these quotes, the alpha needs to let him know his place with strength, but also with calm. So you can't just rule through brute force. You have to be tender, and you have to be tender, and you also have to be calm as a leader. You can't just be, it's the Machiavellian thing. Like, you don't want to be loved or feared. You got to be a little bit of both. And my main thing is, this is the central theme of the movie, I would say, is he was not born alpha. He had to earn it. And then throughout the movie, of course, he ends up nursing this wolf and making its friends, and he becomes a leader in that sense. I don't know if he becomes a leader at the end of the story or not, but that central thesis of the movie right there is that the wolf is the alpha and the leader, but the leader has to be caring, not just strong, but above all has to be brave, and things will test you. And then we get, finally, they find, we get back to where they were in the movie with the hunt. I don't know why they did this time jump. Could have just done it in order. I guess I see why now, because they wanted to add the wolf thing. But the guy's mourning, and the other clan member is like down at the bottom where they're butchering all the bison, looking up at the cliff where the guy's screaming for his son. And he's, I'll see him next time, but tell him our sons will walk together in the next life, which was hints at afterlife. They got their bases done. And there's the huge bison run, which is where they jumped them off the cliff and you can see them cutting up meat and carrying it. And this is just HBE, like human behavioral ecology. Like, you get a lot of calories for how much, you'd invest a lot to get there. It was a strenuous journey. The mom thought the kid might not make it. But once you get that, you get all that stuff. And I'd imagine back then, unless they're like mainly collectors, they would have moved the whole campsite towards where that bison cliff jump was. So they're closer to the meat and have to trek all the way out there to get it. What can you do? And then they have a little funeral for the son. They put a rock on the cairn. The rock's painted. I thought that was, it looks like a Yoshi egg. Thought that was pretty cool that there's a funeral. Like, it had all the rites except for marriage in the movie. They had all mainly like the anthropological things I would want to see. And I guess they were married, the husband and the wife. They make the rock cairn for and have a funeral for him. And they have red ochre. He uses red ochre for the funeral, symbolic ochre, which is very human, very archaeological. And then the son comes too. Falls on the side of the cliff where Andor falls in Rogue One. Just the little platform that always saves you from falling to your death. And then he falls into the water when there's a rainstorm. So that way he doesn't hit the ground. He falls into the water naturally. And here's where the Revenant starts, where he's like trying to survive on his own. And his leg's broken. So he has to then set his leg back into place. And I texted my friend, who's a bioarchaeologist. And he was like, yeah, there's evidence, some evidence of it. But it's hard to tell because you can just see that legs break and are healed. But there's also like cemeteries from like the 1840s where people had broken legs and didn't know how to set it. So it just depends on where you're at. But then, yeah, this is where his survival journey starts. And he's like eating worms and he's eating putrid water and just trying to live. And his legs, he's got a gimp leg. And then he's sleeping in a tree. He's eating worms. And when he sleeps in the tree is where they first encounter the wolves. And the wolves know he's wounded. He's in their territory. and they start barking at him and they start to tree him, which is what we use dogs to do. We use dogs to tree other animals and then shoot them out of the tree. In this sense, the wolf is treeing the... This is in the Black Mirror Metalhead episode with the robot dogs, but like the robot dog trees the human. And it's like the dogs now inheriting the earth and forcing the human back into the trees. In this sense, like the wolves are forcing the human back into the tree. He's in his like most infantile, I mean, not infantile, his most like vulnerable state as an animal. And then he stabs one of them because it starts to bite him. And then the next day she's like there laying on the ground still. And clearly the rest of the pack abandoned her, just like him. And he then puts a muzzle on her, which is wild. It just ties a rope around her and then starts to heal the wound. And hyenas start to come for him. And remember, cave hyenas were huge. Cricuta cricuta spalea. Big ass animals that would have just been all over the grasslands and like caves and stuff in Europe, Paleolithic Europe, which I find really cool and scary. And they start to chase after them because they see two half-dead things laying there. And he picks up the wolf and brings her into a cave. And he starts nursing the wolf in the cave and he starts talking to her. And like language between the wolf and the human start. And I think there were two wolves in the movie. I don't remember their names. There was like a dog bred to look like a wolf, like a Temaskin or a Malamute or something. And then a lot of CGI to make it look more like a wolf. He starts nursing the wolf, like cleaning its wound. And he's talking to her like, hey, I got to clean the wound. And he's like, you'll eat when I tell you to. And like, you can see the wolf's body language and his body language. And they start to, they're showing you how like humans and wolves can actually interact. And then the main thing is he gives her a bowl of water and takes the muzzle off, or she takes it off herself. Gives her the bowl of water, gives her a little piece of rabbit meat. And by giving the rabbit meat, the wolf then knows, okay, he's safe. He'll give me food. But they really do show you there that the universal language that allows humans and wolves to talk is not sit, stay, fetch. It's giving them food. And that's how wolves came to, it's like a mutual language of food. And that's like how the human and dog relationship became to be. But it's of course their first like interaction that's positive in this movie is giving each other food, which I thought was, he's giving the dog food, but there you go. This is where the movie starts to get, and one other aspect I want to add here too is a good long scene is in this cave where he's nursing the wolf back to health. And they're safe from the hyenas and he's making a spear. They have a fire. There's food. It's in a cave. What do I describe it? Like you're seeing from the inside of the cave out with them in it. But obviously the outside is like all blue screen or green screen. And it was just a really cool set design. It was just so simple. They're in a cave, but it's the clothing and the stone all over the place and his tools that make it very convincing that it's the Paleolithic. You like forget that you're on a big green screen. I thought that was really well done. And then, like, I would say the cave is, like, the main area of the movie where you remember. If I think of the movie, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm in the cave. But then he starts hunting with the wolf, and I don't think the wolf would start fetching like he does. Like, he's running after stuff, bringing it back. But they do show you cooperative hunting. Like, the wolf's chasing, like, a rabbit or something, or pig or peccary. And then he's, like, stabbing it while the wolf brings it closer to him and bites it. And it's this cooperative hunting thing, which... in an accuracy that wouldn't happen overnight with a wolf. Maybe it will. I don't know too many wolves up close to tell you that's the case, but I doubt it. They're just showing you the human and dog thing. But then they're sleeping together at camp and then he wakes up and the wolf's licking him. And it's like, that is a wolf thing. Wolves do lick each other. They have dominance and hierarchy things with each other. That's how they speak, tail wagging, like rolling over, showing their teeth. It's all language. And like they're showing the human and the wolf do this together. Now, of course, the wolf they're using in the movie is a domestic dog, so it's going to have a little bit different biology and be able to do these things. But yeah, I thought it was nice. It's just like cute. Like it's a buddy cop show. It's they're forming a bond or whatever. And then they hunt a boar together. And you're like, the wolf chases the boar and then he stabs it and puts it out of its misery, which he couldn't do before. Remember, he was too scared to do it, but he has to do it. And now this wolf is empowering him to like, I don't have to just survive for me. I have to help this wolf, which, you know, of course, the dad told him, like, you have to be calm and you got to be strong at the same time. And then another wolf comes up at night to the camp and I guess presumably one of her pack. And there's this little standoff and are their pack. And then she leaves. And this is like where in every hero's journey story, I guess Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, there's always an orphan with no mother or father who has magical powers. So Harry Potter, or Luke Skywalker, raised by an uncle like Obi-Wan. Harry Potter's raised by the Dursleys. Then they get on this big journey and they find out more about their magical powers and their ancestry. and they use their magical power to fight evil. And there's always, at one point, the Dark Night of the Soul is what it's called, where Jesus is tempted by Satan. Harry Potter, I can't remember exactly what the Dark Night is in that. In, what do you call it? In Star Wars, the main one is Obi-Wan dies, and Vader wins, and that duel, I know, it looks like that'd be the Dark Night, and they're all sad, but it's like, that moment is where he's, okay, I have to step up. I don't have my teacher anymore. And in this movie, they have this whole montage of them like getting along in the commercial to Imagine Dragons. It's really like goofy, but there winter comes and then the wolf leaves with the other wolf. And so he's alone again and he's cold and he's alone. He starts to have dreams of his parents. And I would say his superpower in this movie is one, communicating with the wolf, but also his like his ability to bond. He's very close with his mother and father to the point where he has like psychic dreams about them, or just it's psychic to us to in that way, but it's just the way the director's way of showing us what's going on at the same time. But his connection to his parents is, let's say, his force power. Like it keeps him going. He's having dreams of his parents, and at a certain point, and he's worried that his mom thinks he's dead. So he like, that's, I need to get back. Then he falls in ice at one point, and then of course the wolf comes and saves him and saves him right there. And there was this whole sequence in the original cut of the movie where this other woman that's his age comes and helps him and saves him, but they completely scrapped that because now that I've seen the movie 3 times, it's like, why would that wouldn't make any sense. So maybe there was more to it, but anyway, yeah, it was all his own journey. But he falls in the ice, he gets out, he makes a fire, which he couldn't do before. Now he can even make a fire when he's soaking wet, which he's learned and he's grown. And then he's like cuddling with the wolf at night to keep warm, which is, yeah, kind of cool. And I was asked to audition for Alone, but like a version of it with dogs. It wasn't called Alone. It was a different show. And they wanted me to like showcase things like in the audition, like sleeping with my dog for warmth and like using his hair to start fire. And I was like, what the hell? But I told them like, does my dog get fed? Because a hungry dog's like an angry dog, especially if there's a film crew around. There'll be food for the dog, but not for you. And I was like, okay, this is weird. And of course it never got greenlit. But then they find a frozen dude sitting in a yurt who just looks at The Shining. He's just frozen sitting there, and they think he's real, but he's dead. And I think it's supposed to look like Ötzi, and there's no food in the shelter for him, but there's lots of tools, and he finds, and he's like pissed, he's throwing shit, but he finds a bow in there, and the bow somehow, while the man is frozen to death, has frozen in a blizzard, presumably, the bow is still completely strung up and fine with using archaic sinews. What can you do? Bow and arrows didn't exist 20,000 years ago in Europe, at least physical evidence of them possibly existed in Africa by 70,000 years ago, but in Europe, I don't know. And then a storm from that same storm that killed that guy, presumably, it catches up with them and it pushes them, sends a bunch of hyenas running from it towards them. And then they have to run from the hyenas and they go into a cave. And with that, a cave lion is in there, and we'll be right back with this commercial break. Okay, and we're back. Now they get pushed into the cave and he has to use the bow. Of course, the wolf is fighting the cave lion. It's either a scimitar cat or a European lion. I don't know what it would have been. It had saber teeth, but those didn't exist in Europe. Let's just say a cave lion. And it is attacking and he's not sure where to shoot. It's like an I Am Legend. There's the dog fight between the dogs and his dog, and he like has to shoot one. And he's like, closes his eyes and just takes a guess that he's shooting the lion. And of course he does. And then the wolf starts limping and it's really sad. And the wolf from this point on is like mortally wounded and he's carrying it. And he's, I'm going to get you back home because they'll help you. Like they'll heal you kind of thing. And he's like, now at this point determined, because the thing that just saved his life, he's got to repay the favor and save hers, or the wolf's, anyway, it's a girl. And then they get back home. He collapses outside the campsite. And the father's, you're alive. And the mother's, you're alive. Oh my God. And then they like nurse him back to health, but he's, wait, there's another. And then they find the wolf and they're like, whoa. And they bring the wolf inside and there's this big, how do I say this? I think this is, yeah, it's in the same spot. He's, you can't die. We've come so far together. Like he says that in whatever Proto-Dene-Caucasiatic language they're speaking. We've come so far together is like what he says. And it's like the bond is like at its peak. And there's this nice spiritual Native American flute music going on. And there's the shamans like healing. And there's, I know in Native American society, especially in Powhatan, which is like the English documented with where Pocahontas is from, she's Powhatan. Turtles were like a very healing thing. And there's, you do see a turtle shell in here that's like full of some kind of incense or something burning in it, which I thought was a nice touch. And he remembers his father saying to him, Kata does, remembers his father saying that he is strong, and like his family ties is his power. His bond with his family is his like mystical, that's his force, or that's his wizardry in Harry Potter, right? And that's keeping the dog alive, the wolf alive. And actually, I think that was all, I'm mixing scenes together here, but that was before he got home. Then he gets home, the turtle shell healing thing. The shaman then notices that it's female and that the wolf is pregnant. And then like they pull out the pups and hold up the pups and do this whole Lion King thing. And he's like, oh my God, I didn't know you were a girl. So not only did he save the wolf's life, but he saved all of her pups. And they like hold up the puppies and she's, the shaman says something. And we welcome you into our tribe. She says, we welcome you into our tribe. And then he says, repeats that same line to the wolf after she's given birth and they're passing the puppies around and stuff. But this gets into the domestication theories, which I should have prefaced in the beginning. If you watch my lecture, there's the self-domestication hypothesis, which is that wolves just, you know, ones that were inherently more docile came closer and closer to humans. And then there's the artificial selection hypothesis, where humans were just killing wolves that were aggressive, and like later on, only the softer ones were around. The flight distance hypothesis, wolves that were like less timid of humans, or more timid of humans fled, and like less, more the aggressive ones got killed. So it's a mix of either. But then I see one all the time that like, oh, it's just that humans were picking up wolf pups from their den. I doubt people just went around collecting wolf pups out of their den, because you'd see a lot more broken fingers or bit off fingers, I'd say. You see a lot of frostbite fingers back then that are missing, even in hand sprays too, like missing fingers in hand sprays. But I'd imagine after thousands of generations of, I would say hundreds of generations of wolves that are becoming more used to humans being around. They're safer. They'd feel safer letting their pups scavenge human camps, right? And then we'd be picking up the pups. I doubt you're just going out and picking them up like it's Professor Oak's lab, picking up a Pokemon. So this movie kind of shows that, like in a good, I liked this. That is actually a believable way. Like wolves, like the wolf trusted the people enough and then it gave birth. And then those pups were able to be socialized around human camps more. And of course, then the final scene of the movie, he's like holding the wolf up with the puppy, and it does this little howl, and he's like, we welcome you into our tribe. And then the absolute final shot of the movie, which again, I can't iterate enough how awesome the sweeping like landscape photography of this movie was. Like, it's just really cool. And like at one point, like the whole video screen is like a 360 to show you the passage of time and stuff. It was really fun, like camera play and storytelling play in that sense. But it's not Emmanuel Lubezki who did Children of Men or The New World or Gravity or anything like that. But the final scene of the movie is now that Kata's a man, and he proved himself as let's not say a man as in like man versus woman, but he's like an adult, has proved himself. He did the leadership thing where he was caring. He fought, people are going to challenge his dominance, like the hyenas, the other wolf pack did. Winter challenged him, the blizzard challenged him, yet the wolf and him kept their bond together. That was his force power. They stayed together. And at the end of the movie, not only is he like ready to go back out on a hunt, they go back out on the hunt. And it's like this awesome, like blue background shot of a sunrise where it's kind of like night. And like the whole hunting party is going out, but like wolves in between them. It's a really cool shot. I liked it a lot. I might get my computer background now, actually. It'd be a sick shirt. But yeah, he like fundamentally, it's like the beginning of the movie. He's like, I said, pussy. And I hate using that word because it has such a negative connotation. But he's just, ninny sounds dumb. He's just incompetent, inept, scared. A baby, a boy. Let's just say that. And like now he's not. And like he fundamentally changed human history by going on this Jesus in the desert, Luke on Dagobah, Harry Potter in the closet, or whatever Harry Potter, the forest, sorry, thing. I can't remember Sorcerer's Stone. There's so many Harry Potters. Harry Potter clearly does something like that. I guess it's the chess game. They go through the backside of Hogwarts where the three-headed dog, there's a dog there. Three-headed dog goes through hell. Yeah, there you go. Plays chess there with the life-size chess. I'm digressing. But yeah, he like the force powers he has, or like his special power as the hero in the story, is the bond he has with these wolves, and using that power and like inadvertently changes the course of human history. And that's what the movie wanted to show you. But yeah, that's the end of the movie. I would say I'd give it like a 10 out of 10. But if you I wouldn't say 10 out of 10. It's a good, if you want to pop in a movie and watch something, you're going to have to watch the subtitles and stuff. It's like a 9 out of 10. And I should say, like, Inglourious Basterds to me is like an 11 out of 10. But if you wanted to, there's nothing wrong with this movie, really. It's empty. There could be way more going on in the background. There could be a lot more dialogue. There could be a lot more, like, twists and turns and stuff. But if you just want a fun movie to watch with your kids that's about wolves and dogs in terms of historical accuracy and is it palatable? Yeah, this movie is better than 10,000. If I had to give 10,000 BC a 5, this would be like a 10 for sure. But it's not nowhere near one of my favorite movies. It's not like Oscar winning by any means. It's just to watch on an airplane, I give it a 10. It's like fun, just a chill movie. But that's about it. And I popped in here this thing like, what are some themes of the movie? And I just jotted them down. But survival and coming of age, which I think I hit. Man's relationship with animals, of course. And like the, not just the wolf, but the hyenas and the lion. And like the wolf was the in-between of those animals. Like he helped defend him further from the other animals and the elements. And then trust and cooperation. He was a very trepidatious and scared kid in the beginning. And then having to go through this harrowing journey himself, he like learned trust and cooperation with the wolf. And that led him to his strength. Find his strength. Isolation and connection was a big theme of this, I'd say, too. Just like the Revenant. In that isolation, like Jesus in the desert or Luke on Dagobah, like he has to come face his fears and grow. And then human resilience and adaptability is the other main theme here that I pulled up. And yeah, it just kind of like the Revenant. It's just the Revenant's way more gritty. And the fact that guy's still alive is wild in the movie. And although the real story is very different, but yeah, just their adaptability. And not only did he adapt and overcome the situation, but he like fundamentally changed history by creating the first domestic dog, unquote. I'll just end the episode there. I thought it was great. If you watched the movie, let me know what you thought in the comments here. Did you hate it? Did you love it? Could it have been better? What would you like to see? Did you like the dog aspect? What are some of the movies you'd like me to look at? But yeah, I've got a lot of people asking me about this one and I figured like, why not just do the video finally? So please rate and review the podcast on Apple and Spotify. You can leave comments on Spotify. You can leave comments here on YouTube. Please hit that subscribe button if you like this video. Please share it with somebody else that you think might like it. And as always, you can find my stuff on davidenhow.com/store. And also the Archaeology Podcast Network has its own store as well. You can go to archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, archpodnet.com. And then, yeah, please rate and review, subscribe, listen to anything else on the Archaeology Podcast Network. And with that, I will see you in 2 weeks. Bye.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.